David, you knew Sol Kersner, the late Sol Kersner. He passed away Saturday night. I guess there aren't too many South African businessmen who have made quite the imprint that he did on the world.
I remember him very well because I actually spent my honeymoon, which was in 1971, at Beverly Hills. And that was his first venture into luxury hotels. And from then on, of course, Sol's name became known. You know, here was this man who I think his parents owned some hotels down in Durban. I don't remember his history. But I mean, from then on, you know, what Sol did, there wasn't a year that went by where he didn't do something exceptional. And he took on the world, you know, by saying taking on the world, the $1 million at Sun City. He was the first person. I mean, there was just so many. Well, and a very, very colorful man.
Well, we've got the right person to give us insights into Sol. And we cross to London now, or to the UK anyway, to Ian Douglas. Ian, how long were you and Sol friends? And, well, how long did you work for him?
Yeah, morning, Alec. It's nice to be on your show. I worked for Sol for just 20 years. But, I mean, I knew him for much longer than that. I knew him, for probably, most of my adult life. I, in fact, remember very clearly when first time I actually saw him was when he was walking into the Sun City main sort of foyer there, the very impressive foyer down by the casino, with Annalyn Creel on his arm after the Frank Sinatra concert. And I think that was in about 1979.
Well, then David's honeymoon would have been a few years before that. Do you remember that early history? Sol's parents, did they own hotels?
Yes, I do. Yes, absolutely. No, I know the history well. Yes, his parents, in fact, they came out to South Africa in the 30s from what was then Poland, or, it was kind of between Poland and Russia. They settled in South Africa, and then Sol was born in 1935, so 84, as you said in your previous remarks, and they actually ran a cafe in Bears Valley in the area, south of Joburg, which was a rough neighborhood in which Sol grew up. But they owned hotels, a couple of hotels. The first hotel they purchased the lease on was a hotel called the Menorah, obviously the Menorah from the Jewish faith, the candle, as you know. And that was a tiny hotel, and then they purchased something called the Palace Hotel. But Sol's real first sort of break, as it were, was in 62 when he bought the lease on what was called the Astra Hotel in Durban, which was a small hotel, but which he started the first sort of proper nightclub, offering in Durban, which was called the Talk of the Town. And that was in 62.
Is it still around, the Astra?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's probably been converted into some kind of residential development now.
But
it's behind all the other hotels that he built, such as the Elangeni, the Maharani, etc., on the Durban beachfront.
Yeah, what used to be called the Golden Mile. I'm sure they still call it the Golden Mile in Durban.
Correct, yeah. I think that's right.
How come Sol went into accountancy first off? Because if you just traced his background, were his parents keen to, as immigrants often are, to give him an education in inverted commas? Is that why he became a CEO?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. He was apparently a very diligent student. That's what he used to tell me. He was I think looking for a solid profession, as so many young kids were in those days, and went off and started chartered accountancy at WITS, and graduated and went to a accounting firm called Walbert and Abrams, which was one of the leading Durban firms. Durban, as you know, of course, at that time was the sort of place to be. Cape Town at that point in South Africa's history was kind of not really that well celebrated, that well known. Durban was where everyone went from Johannesburg. And he was with Walbert and Abrams for a few years. And I think, just clearly decided he wanted to get into hospitality. And that was when he made the move to lease the Astra, and then the first venture, of course, the Beverly Hills, which was opened in December of 64, in Umhlanga Rocks. And I remember Umhlanga Rocks at that time, Alec, was, you know, cane fields, sugar cane fields. There was nothing out there. And he saw this piece of land, which was next to, you know, sort of seaside weekend cottage type thing. And he decided that that was where he was going to build, you know, South Africa's first five-star hotel, 90 rooms. He went overseas one trip. I think he allowed himself one trip, and he flew to Miami, or through New York to Miami. He always used to tell the very famous story that he was in the elevator in one of the buildings in New York. And in those days, of course, they had elevator ladies who used to operate the elevators. And this lady was in tears, floods of tears. And he asked her, you know, what's wrong? You know, can I help? And she said, no, our president has just been shot. And that was, of course, Kennedy, who was shot around that time. I don't remember the exact date. But he went on this trip and he basically explored what he thought were the leading hotels of that sort of seaside location of Miami and Florida. And he came back and he built what he felt was his version of that to bring five-star luxury to South Africa.
Incredible that he way ahead of his time in so many respects, but in that way too. Nowadays, if we want to build something in this country, we do go and look internationally. He was very driven, though. Talking to everybody's got their soul curse in the story. So, talking to people who worked for him, it was not unusual to get a 2 a.m. phone call from Mr. Kersner to say, "I need to meet with you now." Where did this come from?
No, absolutely. I mean, he was very driven. He was a guy who, you know, had a temper. It was well known he had a temper. But the great thing about Sol was that you always knew where you stood from him. Somebody once said to me, you know, you're in trouble when Sol stops talking to you. Because, you know, he was always just very engaged and always on top of all the detail. And if he stopped talking to you, he clearly had written you off and was going to move on. But yes, he used to call people at all times of the night. He was, you know, he's a guy who got his hands very dirty. I mean, he used to be on the site at, you know, whatever, 5 a.m. or midnight, what have you. And that was the way he worked. He didn't seem to have much need for sleep like some of the other, you know, great leaders of the world. And he, you know, he used to just keep going. He, of course, was drinking quite heavily at the time, but, you know, he gave up alcohol and cigarettes when he was about 70 and was teetotal for the rest of his life.
He comes from a working class background, as you've explained, Bez Valley, pretty tough those days. He was also fairly short. I remember meeting him a few times, I'm not sure what, 5'6" or so, but
probably about 5'6", 5'7", something like that. Yeah.
But as a result, he must have been picked on, I guess, as kids do. And then he took up boxing, and I love that saying that you in the incredible eulogy that you guys put together that Sol would say keep boxing on or just box on.
Yeah, you got to box on. Yeah, you got to box on. I mean, you're right. He was well known for that expression, and he was one of those guys who, you know, it was a bit of a dichotomy in a way, because, you know, he played in the symphony orchestra in Johannesburg when he was a kid, and at the same time, you know, took up boxing and became the welterweight champion of Wits University. He always used to say he took up boxing out of self-defense. He grew to love the sport. You know, he thought it was one of his great passions. And he used to, you know, do a lot of boxing fights with a very good friend of his, a very close friend, one of his best friends, Bob Arum, the legendary Bob Arum of Top Rank. But he was certainly one of those guys who certainly came from, you know, the more difficult side of the tracks or the rough side of the tracks and made good. And I think that was a great thing about Sol. He kind of never really forgot his background or his origins. He was, you know, he was someone who, some of his best friends were the guys that he was at school with or in the army with, and they remained his friends till his dying day.
He also, well, you mentioned Bob Arum, who I think most South Africans of a more mature age would remember brought world boxing to this country, even champions in Gerry Coetzee. But he is also incredibly well connected elsewhere. When you mention names like Frank Sinatra, Freddie Mercury, Elton John, Shirley Bassey, Liza Minnelli, he knew them all very well and managed to bring them to what was then a very isolated South Africa.
Yeah, that's right. He knew them all. He liked to spend time with them, and I think they liked to spend time with him. And Bob Arum is still today working in boxing. It's quite a remarkable story. He's over 80, and he's just one of those guys that keeps on going. And he's working with his son in the business, I think, and it's going really well. But yes, he knew a lot of famous people, and he made it his business to know them, and brought them out, as you said, to South Africa in groundbreaking events. David, your previous guest was mentioning the million dollar. I mean, when the million dollars started, $1 million was a huge sum of money. There was no other golf tournament in the world that offered that sort of prize money, and that was Sol's genius. The story behind the $1 million is an interesting one, though, because it was actually Lee Trevino, who was a friend of Sol's, who said to him, if you really want to kind of get yourselves on the map, if you want people to know where South Africa is and where Sun City is, offer a prize of $1 million. And that was what he did.
Fascinating. He always thought bigger than everyone else. When he built the Lost City, it was, Sun City itself, but then the Lost City was a huge amount of money, I recall, over R1 billion for those days. What was it about him? How can the rest of us lesser mortals learn from someone who somehow just didn't seem to have any limits to his ambitions and dreams?
Yeah, I think I think it was one of those things where Sol, dreamed big, but it was also practical. I mean, he had a real grasp of the numbers, so it wasn't just fantasy stuff and somebody writing big checks. He really sort of understood what drove people. He understood, I think, what true hospitality meant, and he did his homework. So I think, look, you can never deny the fact that the Palace of the Lost City was a leap of faith. But I think, when Sol did a project like that, he always said, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm going to get the best people in the world to work with me on this. And he'd bring in talent and, he'd create something that was unique, that was memorable, and he'd execute it exceptionally well. And I think, that's the story. I think it's being able to combine that huge vision with being able to execute on the detail and making sure that you can, combine those two really key ingredients for any successful business.
Yeah, I've seen that with great business entrepreneurs time and again. They know the big stuff, but they also understand the detail. You did mention Bob Arum's working with his son. From Sol's point of view, when his son died, and Butch was extremely highly rated by pretty much everybody. I remember talking to people after he died in 2006, and he was hugely regarded as really walking in his father's footsteps. Did that knock his dad back?
Yeah, I think, nobody ever recovers from the loss of a child. It's an awful thing, to happen. And what was, I had the privilege of working with Butch as well. And, Butch was a remarkably good foil to his dad. They had some similarities, but they complemented each other so wonderfully. And you're right. He was a very talented guy and he was, had in a very promising career in corporate finance, working, I think it was Lehman Brothers. It wasn't Lehman Brothers. I think it was, it was one of the big companies in the States, and Sol persuaded him to come and work for him and join him. And he then became CEO of the company, and he had been CEO of the company for 2 years when he was killed in a helicopter smash in 2006 in the Dominican Republic. I was at the time in Singapore, which I think is an interesting story as well, because it demonstrates Sol's grit. and determination. I was working on the bid that we were putting together for the Singapore casino license, which we subsequently lost, unfortunately. But Sol literally, you know, went to New York, buried his son in New York, and got on a plane and flew across the world for 26 hours to get to Singapore to come and make the presentation to the government on the submission that we had made. And, you know, he was one of those guys who he said, I want to do this for Butch. Butch believed in this project and I wanted to get it done. And that was the determination of this remarkable man.
Extraordinary man, extraordinary story, not without controversy. As I mentioned on Biz News, that I went off all the way to Mauritius to interview him in 1994 about all the controversy about alleged corruption with, I think it was Kaiser Matanzima and Transcar. What did he told me he completely denied that there was anything to it. What did he say to you guys about the way that he was continuously targeted on that?
Yeah, look, I think he was, it was something that got to him. It was something that upset him. But it was something that I think, you know, he was ultimately redeemed from, in the sense that, you know, Christo Noel, the Attorney General of the Transkei, formally dropped all those charges against Sol Kersten in 1997. I think what's important as well, Alec, is to say that, you know, Sol went on after those allegations to be licensed around the world to operate casinos. He was licensed in the UK and he was licensed in Atlantic City, New Jersey, which is known in the casino industry to be the toughest jurisdiction in the world to get licensed. So, you know, what I'm saying is that if you get licensed in Atlantic City by the Casino Control Commission of the state of New Jersey, you know, they've gone through the detail and they've gone through the stuff and they've clearly satisfied themselves that there's nothing there because they don't take any chances on this stuff.
For sure.
So I think that's an important point to make on this thing. And I think it was sad that it kept on going. I think South Africa was going through a challenging time and there were clearly, you know, a lot of different points of view on this. But I think that was where it ended up.
Yeah, and I went through something similar when I joined the board of Pumalela, which was in the gaming field, much, much smaller, obviously, than Atlantic City. But you don't get those licenses if you aren't, pretty squeaky clean. Yeah. He did die in South Africa, so clearly that didn't alienate him from the land of his birth.
No. He was, Sol was spending a huge amount of time in South Africa, you know, right through his life. And he at no stage ever stayed away. He loved South Africa. He loved the rugby, he loved the cricket, and you know, all that South Africa represented. He came back, he spent a lot of time at the Johannesburg Hotel School, which he founded in Auckland Park there, and he loved being with the students and used to visit them every year and speak to them and, you know, tell them about what he thought were the things to think about in hospitality. No, I mean, Sol was in South Africa all the time. He, in fact, spent probably the last 8 months of his life in Cape Town at Leeukoppe, which is his home. And that was sadly where he passed away, surrounded by his family and his friends, but his family particularly, of course. And he was buried yesterday in Cape Town. And the family were present. I think, you know, everyone is very aware of this awful COVID-19 pandemic, and the family didn't want to do anything irresponsible, so they kept the family funeral very private. Just the family were involved to not expose anybody to the risks of large gatherings.
But even on his passing, he didn't go out without a little bit of controversy there too. Fake news earlier in the day. How did all of that come about? Yeah.
Look, I don't truthfully know what happened, but I know that Jeremy Mansfield, who I must say was very gracious about it and very apologetic about it. I think he was the first one to post that Sol had passed away on what would have been Friday night, which was wrong. And I don't know how Jeremy got the story. Well, I do, actually. He said he was told it by two very reliable sources. He named the sources to me, and I'm not going to go into that now, but they were clearly wrong. You know, and unfortunately, what happened as a consequence of that was that then the Sun International, the company that Sol founded in South Africa, also published a statement totally in good faith, believing that he had passed, and the story just went out. And we managed to get everyone to withdraw the statements, and then, you know, sadly, he did pass on the night of the Saturday, as you mentioned, just before 7 p.m.
Yeah, just to close off with, what did you think about South Africa today? Clearly, in the past, he was one of the hugest supporters. He was a big fan, yeah, and I think friend of Nelson Mandela's. Yeah. What did he make of where we are?
Look, we talked about it a bit. I think he felt that the era of the previous president, Mr. Zuma, was a time that that was very sad for South Africa. That there was a lot of things that were happening that were very bad for the country, and he certainly didn't know, you know, he didn't know how to deal with that. He thought it was a great tragedy. I think in terms of the current leadership, I think he was a great fan of President Ramaphosa. But I think most importantly, what Sol felt was that South Africa had this extraordinary, you know, set of assets, the people who are just naturally hospitable and great ambassadors for the country, the assets, you know, in the geography and the topography and the weather. And he just felt this country had great potential. So I think he was saddened by some of the declines that had happened with the infrastructure and that. But he always used to come back here, and he was a great supporter and a great defender of South Africa on the international markets and with his international friends and acquaintances. He loved South Africa. It was his home. It always would be his home. And in fact, what was interesting as well was that Sol never ever took up citizenship of any other country. He remained a South African. He traveled on a South African passport. That, of course, had its challenges as well, and I was often sorting out those challenges of getting visas for all sorts of places. But he remained true to South Africa right to the end.
Ian Douglas, a friend and, as you heard, a longtime colleague of the late Sol Kersens. May he rest in peace. David, it is a Jewish tradition, isn't it, that you get buried the next day? And so he died Saturday night. He was buried on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes they'll delay it to wait for members of the family, but they don't like to delay it too long. In fact, in the very religious communities, they bury you almost immediately, you know, literally within an hour or so of you dying, even if it is at night. But that is a tradition. I'm interested to see he was buried in Cape Town. I thought that maybe Johannesburg, you know, where he had been brought up. So that's interesting to hear as well. But I suppose that's where his love was. You know, he was very well. Everybody knew that he loved his homestead in the Cape. You know, there's an interesting story that Ian brought up about his friends, because I played soccer and I'm still friendly with a man by the name of Hilly Chimes. And old Hilly, when I was playing at Wits, you know, Hilly was he's older than me, and he had met Sol in the army and remained a lifelong friend. And when Sol had a party, whatever it is, he would fly Hilly there, you know, wherever he went. And, you know, to this day, until the tragedy, he was a lifelong friend of Hilly's, you know. And Hilly always say, "Oh, I'm going to see Sol." And two different characters, you know. Hilly laid back, successful businessman, but not of Sol's stature. But Sol never forgot him for those few months that they spent in the army together.
It's quite extraordinary that somebody gets to, and Ian made that point as well, that he never forgot his old friends. That someone gets to that level on a global stage. You know, you're rubbing shoulders and sharing jokes with a Frank Sinatra, and then if Hilly were to walk past, you wouldn't ignore him. You'd go and give him a hug too. Absolutely. Well, I suppose not today, but in the past.
But that's what's fascinating, and you know, that's what I find. I always found endearing about Sol, with all his never forgot Hilly. You know, and Hilly was cool about it as well. He was a great chap, Hilly. You know, and just took it in his stride. But they were friends. Whenever I spoke to Hilly and said, "Where did you meet?" "No, we were in the army." And I think in those days it was nothing more than 3 months that you spent together. I don't think it was the 9 months that we had to spend, or a year. So also, yeah, interesting. You know, also, there were a number of occasions where I would go to presentations by Sol. And the one thing that distinguishes him and distinguishes business leaders is that he was always there in the front. You know what I mean? He knew every aspect during the building of Sun City. I mean, every little detail he seemed to have a hand in. And it was a fascinating experience to see the development of it. I think he brought in, and I wish Ian could have been there, I think they brought in some of the Disney designers, you know, the people who designed the Disney theme park. And because a lot of those sculptures are nothing more than polystyrene, you know, covered in a resin, which gave the feeling that these were marble or but beautiful, absolutely beautiful places that he built.